Hi, I'm Tara Lynn of Geek Saga Entertainment, here with my co-host Manny for a holiday special episode of the Geek Saga podcast series, 90s and Naughties Cringe Factor. This series focuses on some of the problematic teen movies and or rom-coms from the 90s and early 2000s that we, isn't love to hate or hate to love.
Either way, I'm Manny, and because this is our special Cringe Factor holiday edition, we'll be discussing the 2003 Christmas season-centric Love Actually.
This thread-weaving movie that takes place during a very hectic London Christmas season came about when writer-director Richard Curtis, who was known for British rom-coms such as Four Weddings and a Funeral and Notting Hill, decided he wanted to explore different forms of love through an ensemble cast. It actually wasn't even supposed to have a Christmas theme, but apparently Curtis has a penchant for holiday films, and that led to him writing it as one.
So Love Actually takes place during what seems like, as we said, a super extra hectic Christmas season in London. Beginning 5 weeks prior to the holiday itself and following a group of mostly loosely connected people as they experience everything from recording and promoting a Christmas album to a wedding, a funeral, an office Christmas party, and eventually a school holiday concert. Relationships and situationships end, begin, and even begin and end as this movie attempts to convince us that, hey, love is actually all around.
Had to do it.
Yeah, you did.
Anyway, we'll begin our discussion with a list of 10 things we hate about this movie, then suck it up and admit 1 to 3 things we actually liked in our These Are All That section. We'll also rate Love Actually on a cringe factor scale of 1 to 10 Zach Morris's before concluding with our Watch This, Not That suggestion for the episode. But before we get started, you can follow me and therefore all of the Geek Saga endeavors at A Geek Saga on Blue Sky, Facebook, Instagram, Threads, TikTok, and YouTube.
And you can find me on the good old Facebook and Instagram at Benissimo Art.
Last but hopefully not least, we hope that you'll check out the Geek Saga Entertainment Patreon with 10 tiers ranging from $1 a month to $40 a month. It's a great way to support us and receive some great perks in return, including early access to 90s and Naughties Cringe Factor podcast episodes. You can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment.
And now it's time for the 10 things we hated about this movie, which in this case is a bit different from our usual Cringe Factor top 10 list, as the first 7 are going to focus on the things we hated about each relationship and or situationship in Love Actually, and then round out the top 10 with a couple of more specific cringy items.
All that said, we might as well begin with a big one, that being an oh-so-cliche middle-aged crisis, a.k.a. how dare anyone even think about cheating on Emma Thompson? Oops, we mean Karen, but not that kind of Karen, damn it. Quick aside to start this, how dare they make Emma Thompson wear a fat suit like they did for this movie? Honestly, why? Why?
I don't know how I missed that. I didn't even notice that she was in
it. I did not notice either. It is something I found when I was kind of just making sure I had details right for our podcast. I found an article that was like, things you didn't know. And I was like, oh, I definitely did not
know. I think probably the reason I missed it is that Emma Thompson is just so distracting. She's so great. Anytime she's on screen, you just pay attention to her 100%. Mm-hmm. You're not thinking about anything else. You're just like, oh, it's Emma Thompson. She's just such a fucking gem that I didn't even think about it. But yeah, why would they put her? I guess they had to make her unappealing compared to the other person, I guess.
I think that's what they were trying to do. But also then that like implies that like, oh, Emma Thompson was like too skinny. Like Alan Rickman's character, Harry, he wouldn't have cheated on his wife, Karen, Emma Thompson, if she wasn't like, I don't know, heavier than Emma Thompson is. Whatever. It's so gross.
Yeah, it's weird.
It's gross and it makes no sense. But just to get into this whole thing about, so cliche middle-aged crisis. I don't know how old they're supposed to be, but they have children who are in like elementary school. So Harry is kind of an all-around asshat. Let's be real. He is nosy and rude about his employees' personal lives. See bugging Sarah about being in love with Carl. Also, if you're watching this and you don't know these characters, I'm sorry. Sarah is Laura Linney's character. Carl is the, I'm sorry, I don't know the actor's name, very sexy graphic designer or something that she's been in love with for several years, as Harry points out. But like, he bugs Sarah about how she's in love with Carl. This is not appropriate, okay? I used to work in HR, but even if I hadn't, we all know this isn't appropriate, right? Right? That is an HR nightmare, even if we set aside the fact that Harry also doesn't immediately tuck and run at Mia's over-the-top flirtation.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this is just a non-thing and I'm just mad about it for personal reasons, but Harry is terrible at, I don't know, planning, delegating, both. Because how is he asking Mia to plan the office Christmas party in like early December? How is there anywhere left to have it? Even her weird friend's weird art gallery. Yeah. Again, we'll get into that later because her weird friend is one of the characters in a other situation show. I don't even know what you want to call it, whatever. How's there anywhere left to have it at this point? Even this place. And I did find an old article. I cannot believe I found this with a Love Actually Watch advent calendar. You actually cannot find this article on the website. It just like loads and loads and loads and nothing happens. But thank you, Wayback Machine. I was able to find the original text of the article. And according to this advent calendar, Harry asks Mia to start planning the party on or around December 4th. As an event planner, this makes my skin crawl. This makes my skin crawl. Like, what?
Okay, so like, let me just play devil's advocate here for a second.
Oh, devil's advocate. Are you trying to get me to talk about Mia?
Yeah. So a lot of office parties are just kind of, does it take a long time to like, I mean, aside from the food, what else would you do to get that set up? Because in my brain, since I've never dealt in that position, I can understand if you were like going to a place or like, yeah, we're going to have it at a park or at some restaurant, but.
Well, and that's the thing. It's how he asks her or tells her to plan it. That's the problem. It's not like, oh, we're a company of 10 people. Let's just try to get a dinner reservation somewhere. Mm-hmm. It's we need a place where we can drink a lot and have some food. And all of the people in this apparently way bigger than we can tell office can be there. It's very clear from the way he's asking her to plan it that he expects her to plan like an event, like an actual event, not just like, hey, us like 10 or 15 people from our small company office are, you know, going to go have a holiday dinner.
Gotcha.
But speaking of devil's advocate, I just want to touch on Mia because who the fuck wears a devil? I guess it's not a costume, but it's devil horns and a sexy red dress to a Christmas party, but a work Christmas party. Okay. Mm-hmm. Like you do you. I guess, but work Christmas party? I'm going to my work Christmas party next week, which by the time this comes out is a podcast and put up on YouTube and stuff. I will have probably already gone to that Christmas party. No, I will have already gone to that Christmas party. And I'm like hemming and hawing about what the fuck I'm going to wear. Still, though, who the fuck wears a devil costume essentially to a work Christmas party? But that aside, Mia is, her whole character is just like a very basic trope. A stereotype. Yeah. She is made for the viewers of this movie to hate.
Yeah.
Boo, blah. Why does she like Harry? She hasn't even worked there that long. He's like, oh, how are you liking it here so far? She's been there for like, let's say she's been there for like a couple of months. Okay.
Yeah.
I'll give her a few months. What about this man has made you decide to like spread your legs in the office?
Yeah.
Like, I'm not trying to shame her as like a character or a woman even. I'm shaming the fucking writer for writing this.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to make Harry cheat on Karen, if you're going to make fucking Alan Rickman cheat on Emma Thompson, then you gotta give us
something better.
Reasoning behind it. Well, what's the story here? Oh, it makes me so mad. This makes me so mad. This whole thing makes me so mad.
It's just, I don't know what the writers are thinking. Again, this is like, it's like a caricature, right? We always go back to like in these 90s and naughties things that, you know, all these people write caricatures of like a certain situation. So they're like, hey, you know what? This girl, and she's like the sexy one, and she's going to be all like aggressive and sexy. It's like, why didn't you just make them like relate to each other under pressure or something? You know, like, oh shit, we both work this job. We're working nights all the time. She's just like a nice person. Like that would have made more sense. Like that's someone you buy a necklace for, right? Not just try to like bone them, right? Because you're like, shit, this person is like with me the whole time and we're always, you know, doing the stuff and we're working hard and blah, 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 blah. The devil costume at the Christmas party, like what kind of Christmas party is it? Was it like a dress up Christmas party? Like, hey guys, come as your favorite superhero or something. But then again, I feel like there was kind of like a, she's the other woman, you know? So she's like the devil, you know? So they had to like tell the audience, they had to spell out for the audience, look at her though. She's dressed up like the devil, you know? She's clearly a devil.
That's your favorite thing when they just force the, like, they're like, yes, this is what you should think.
This is what you should think. It's like, why don't you just
them, by the way.
No, of course, of course. But yeah, you're absolutely right. That is my fucking favorite thing. Like, why are you spelling it out for me? Why don't you just have her drinking like the blood of children too while you're at it? And she's like, I'm going to take all of the married men.
Later in the movie, when the prime minister is like searching for his love interest, she opens the door for her flat and she's in like, I think a negligee. And she's like, yeah. Aren't you the prime minister? And she's like, girl. Pick a man.
It was bad.
In a way, I kind of feel bad for not her, I guess. I don't even know how to say this. Like, I feel bad for the character because even she deserved better. She
deserved better than that.
There's no fucking story here. She's literally just put there to make us hate her.
Yep.
Gross.
It doesn't make any sense. I felt like it would have landed and it would have made more sense even for like Alan Rickman's character. Even though he is kind of like a jerk, he does seem like sophisticated, kind of cooler guy, but he's like, you know, professor or whatever the fuck. And you know what I'm saying? That it would be like, make sense to be like, oh, well, this girl is really intelligent or she helps me out. She's the only person who stays late, so I don't have to stay here forever. Like, she has my back. That would have made more sense to me. But she's just like, yeah.
Yeah, like it's still not good, but it makes more sense.
Yeah, this was a caricature of the other woman, you know?
I mean, beyond caricature. Okay, so I wanted to ask you about this because, by the way, everybody, I guess we should have led with this at some point, but this is Manny's first time having ever watched this movie. I saw it in the theater. I think I can trace this back to, I think I saw it at a dollar theater when I lived in Virginia.
Wow.
Back in the end of 2003. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. A dollar. I literally paid a dollar to see this movie in the theater.
Wow.
I really wanted to ask what your thoughts were on the scene where Harry is trying to buy that gold necklace and Mr. Bean, I mean, Rowan Atkinson, is literally just being Mr. Bean about it. Mr. Bean. I needed to know your thoughts on this.
My thoughts on it, quite simple on this. Rowan Atkinson, he's the best at breaking the tension from a situation. He breaks tension by creating tension. That's what he does, right? Because at first he comes out and you're like, oh, it's Mr. Bean. Like, oh, look at that. And oh no, but he's playing a normal character, guys. Don't worry about it. And then you see him putting everything in, like, oh, no. He's playing Mr. Bean. Here it comes. And he just kind of keeps it going. The fact that he kept pulling out more things to put in the bag and wrap it in a certain way was just, it was so classic. He's made so many, I'm not Mr. Bean, but I really am cameos in so many movies now. Every time you see him, he's like the same kind of guy where he's like, oh no, look, I'm not Mr. Bean. I'm an actual actor. And then his beans start coming out, you know? And it's like, oh, no, you're not.
His beans.
Exactly. But you know what? Rowan Atkinson is great. He hasn't lost his touch. You know, he can still do that kind of stuff. I always get happy when I see him. He's like the cool uncle that shows up at your holiday party. You know,
I love that, like, one point where he's like taking out branches of rosemary or something and he's like sniffing it and he pulls off like very specific bits. It's like, oh my God. I want somebody to do that wrapping job for me for literally any present. Okay.
I want Rowan Atkinson to do it. Yeah. I want him to do it as like Mr. Bean, you know? This part of the movie was like the first time where I started getting comfortable with the movie because everyone knows how much Manny loves chaos, right? I just love the chaos. And the second I saw his face, I was like, here we go. I'm like, let's go, guys. You know?
That's the thing. Yeah. Like you know chaos is coming. Maybe he himself is a trope. I don't know.
he probably is a trope, but when he shows up, you know how it's gonna go.
So as for Karen, generally she is great. I love her line. Like, this is probably the most well-written line of the movie, and Emma Thompson delivers it like she's an Oscar award winner, isn't she? If she's not, she should be.
She fucking should be. Yeah, absolutely.
Not for this movie, but like, I freaking love Emma Thompson. I fell in love with Emma Thompson in Sense and Sensibility in 1995. Mm-hmm. But anyway, her line when she says, I'm paraphrasing this first part, your husband bought a necklace and you found it, and then come Christmas, you got a CD and not a necklace. Mm-hmm. And then she says, would you wait around to find out if it's just a necklace or if it's sex and a necklace or if, worst of all, it's a necklace and love? Mm-hmm. Would you stay knowing that life would always be a little bit worse, or would you cut and run? Again, just the way she delivers it, so fucking heart-wrenching. Again, I say, how dare Harry?
That whole monologue is just a classic example of how to like to communicate properly with people. And she just spelled it out really fucking clearly. There was no way around it. I was watching that and I was just like, man, I wish people communicated like this in real life. Yep. Because she could have just not said nothing. She could have wallowed in it, wondered. She could have spied on him. She could have done like all these fucking things. And she was just like this no nonsense. Like, and she wasn't even like mad about it. She's just like presenting it to him as a situation. Mm-hmm. What would you do in this situation? She wasn't being like mad or like emotional or anything.
Well,
just
she's upset. She's emotional, but
clearly
she's
upset.
Not-
She's but she's in like, control, though. You know,
yes,
she's in control.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
And I feel like there would be a lot less weird situations in the world if people just spoke in the same fashion that this happened. I think if there's one takeaway for this entire fucking movie, it is this one scene. I mean, because this was a great fucking scene. Outside of like the 90s and 90s and the funny and how we're going to bash this thing into the ground, like that monologue. Mm-hmm. I was like, holy shit, that was fucking good. Yep. That was fucking good writing right there.
100%. Now that said, I mean, she also has her moments, not so great moments, like the, which doll should we give our daughter's friend, the transvestite or the dominatrix? And I just like, I know this is 2003 when this movie came out, but like I heard transvestite and I was like, no, because I haven't rewatched this movie in a while. I couldn't tell you if I like cringed about that the last time I watched it, but I would assume that if it was in like the last 10 years, I probably did. But whoa. And I guess maybe it's, I don't know, signs of the times, whatever. But yeah. And then there's when she tells her close friend Daniel, whose wife just died like a week ago, maybe less, that if he looks sad all the time, he's never going to get laid.
Mm-hmm.
That's rough.
Especially just because, you know, why don't you wait till the body gets cold before you start saying things like that? Look, I've never been in a position to where I've had a significant other pass away, right? But I've gone through like bad breakups and stuff where I'm kind of hurting. And all the advice I ever got was always the same. Oh, you need to go out and you need to go have sex. You need to go like fucking. And it's like, look, bro, just give me a minute. You know, and I can't even imagine losing a significant other and be like, you know, man, if you walk around with that puss face, you're never going to touch a girl ever again. It's like, dude, I'm putting my wife in the ground. What are you talking about?
Like literally just put his wife.
Literally just did it.
Again, like I get that this is supposed to be her trying to lighten the mood, mm-hmm. but it's also in the midst of them talking about his woes with his sad stepson. So just like, mm-hmm. maybe not right now, Karen.
Yeah. Now isn't the time to go get you some. Well, since we're on the subject of Daniel, second on our 10 things we hated about this movie list is proper grieving period. What's that? Never heard of it.
Okay. Let's take one tiny step back just to point out that Sam, the son of the woman who just died, is apparently not grieving the loss of his mother, like hardly at all or
no.
at all at all. Really, though, he's only depressed and hiding in his room because he's upset about presumably unrequited preteen love.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is this how kids are? I feel like there would be grief there.
Yeah, you would think if it's a mom. And if not, then the kid probably needs help. I lost a grandparent at a very young age and I didn't grieve at all. And I was really attached to her. And I didn't realize until probably like, I don't know, 35, 40 years later that I was like, you know what? I probably should have got some help for that one.
I mean, and this is like a parent and apparently his only actual blood parent that is involved in his life. As we find out very soon, Daniel is actually his stepfather. Mm-hmm. I'll get into that later. I know he's only 11. Or wait, he's only 11? But either way, what? This is a very weird... Like, Richard Curtis, who wrote these movies, like he clearly knows how to write movies. He's put out some really fucking great movies. But also, this is weird. Has this guy never had a parent die? Well, maybe he
no.
had. I don't know. There's a lot here that I'm just like,
There's a lot of things in this movie with some of the other ones that I'm sure we'll bring up.
We will.
Yeah. Like the point of the movie is not about anything else except love, guys, because love actually is whatever. That's the point of the movie, guys. You
actually,
know,
that is like, what love actually is.
Yeah. Love actually
whatever.
Is whatever, right? Like, oh, dude, I'm sorry you lost your job and you're homeless, but are you in love? Dude, yeah, I'm in love with the girl in the tent next to mine. come on, man. You know, but that's the point of the movie. That's what they focus on.
Well, back to Daniel himself. Let's fast forward to the Christmas concert, which, by the way, is apparently on Christmas Eve. Like, it's a school Christmas concert on Christmas Eve. Is that like a UK Europe thing? I don't know. Like, I can't imagine any, like, growing up in like Catholic Central New England, that never would have happened. Are you fucking kidding me?
And in Cuban Miami, that was actually Christmas. Actually, Christmas is like New Year's Eve.
Okay.
Right? That's when we would do everything. Like, sometimes we would open the gifts on the 25th, but most times we were opening them up at midnight on the 24th. The 24th is when we would go out. There's a huge party, you know, at one of our relatives' house, and all the Cubans did this.
Fun.
Yeah. It was like a huge party, a bunch of people, everyone gets wasted. They eat pig. It's a huge, huge thing. The whole Christmas Day, like dinner or whatever, I had never heard of that until I was an adult. I was like, what are you talking about? You guys don't do anything on Christmas Eve? They're like, no, we go to bed early because Santa Claus. I'm like, go to bed early? I was like 7 years old and I was up at 3 a.m. You know, I had no problem going to sleep, you know, after that.
That's so funny because like when I was a kid, we lived close to both my father and my mother's family. So we would go to one of them on Christmas Eve, one of them on Christmas Day. It switched back and forth every year. So we would always go to bed early Christmas Eve, but we would see family and have presents Christmas Eve with one side of the family.
Yeah.
As an adult, when my main part of the family, my parents, my sisters had all moved away from the extended family, it became Christmas Eve was the big dinner thing, the big hangout thing. And then Christmas Day, we would do like brunch. So we would open all the family presents Christmas Eve between each other. And then like my sisters with their kids would have their Santa thing on Christmas morning. And then we would just do brunch together. Anyway, regardless, this concert, this Christmas Eve concert takes place at best 5 weeks after Daniel's wife's funeral. And despite some very positive moments when Daniel is helping Sam, and again, major props to him for all of that, let's be real, Daniel still seemed pretty damn grief-stricken up until this moment at the Christmas concert, this moment that I'm talking about being. But then he runs into Sam's friend's mom, who looks suspiciously like his dream woman, Claudia Schiffer. And he's immediately all eyeballing and flirting with her. And oh my God, the final scene of the movie where people are all like meeting at Heathrow again. This is just 1 month later. I Googled it several different ways. Everybody says it was only 1 month later. Just 1 month later, Daniel and Sam are at the airport with Claudia. Oops, I mean Carol.
Yep.
So obviously that's supposed to signify that they're already dating. And like, yes, everyone grieves differently. And all of that. But also rebounds are a thing. Plus there are children involved and I do.
Yeah. And you would think that you would be really careful with that, in particularly with the child. The child just lost mom. You're going to introduce another woman who is going to be like the stepmom. And then you may decide 6 months down the line, oh, I can't do this. And then that woman's that, you know, the kid's going to have to say goodbye to that woman now.
And his friend, his little school friend.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. Just meh.
Yeah. Nope. Nope.
Okay. Why don't we just take the leap from meh to Christ. No, at Christmas, you do not tell the truth. Never. Especially these days, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah. No.
Nope. Okay. Manny, before we dive into the cringe of this, this might be the time to talk about how the whole like cue cards or prop card scene is the only thing you knew about this.
So I saw like the memes from that. It wasn't even that long. Probably 2 or 3 years ago, I kept seeing like memes. It was trending for some reason and they were doing things or whatever. And I just saw, hey, isn't that the guy from The Walking Dead? You know, like it looks like the guy from The Walking Dead. Is that who that is? What is this? I'd never seen this before. And they would be like, oh, it was from like a romantic comedy. And then somebody else was talking about this movie, Love Actually, a year ago or something. And I was like, oh, I'd never seen that movie. And then I saw that scene and I was like, oh, that was because I watched the trailer is what it was. You know, I was like, I've never seen Love Actually. I'll watch it. Or I didn't watch it at the time. I just looked at the trailer. So I saw that scene and I was like, oh, that's what this is from. So to me, it was the most like iconic part of what this movie was.
I think it really is the most like meme worthy, like iconic thing about this movie, period, which is because going back to the cringe of it all, Mark being in love with Juliet, who is his best friend's wife. Yep. And he's been mean to her, apparently, like the whole time they've known each other, like he's a fucking first grader. Yep. Just, ugh, ah.
Yeah, that scene plays out really good in a trailer.
Oh, yeah, not, in a trailer.
Yeah, not in the actual
outside
movie.
Outside of itself, yeah.
Yeah, outside of itself, yeah, that's great. That's very romantic.
Yeah, when you don't know the context.
When you don't know the context, so you're cute. Like, so romantic. Yeah, and then you watch it in the movie and you're just like, what? I have more to say on this scene, but I saved it for the end of the podcast. But also, like, how is he in love with her? Apparently, he never talks to her to the point where both his best friend, whose name is Peter, by the way, even thinks he doesn't like Juliet at all. And he's, like, mean to her, apparently, and is just kind of, like, cold. Look, I'll say this. I've never been, like, mean to someone because I secretly liked them. I have been cold before. And not cold where I'm just like, oh, my God, that guy's, like, frigid. I just kept my distance, really, when you really think about it. Because I actually really like them, but maybe they're dating, like, a friend of mine or they're just dating somebody, you know? And I'm like, yeah, I don't really want to mess with that. So I just kind of go cold.
Protect yourself. That's
yeah,
fine.
Just protect yourself.
That's totally it. Normal. Mm-hmm. That's yeah. Totally normal. This is not totally normal. Basically, in my opinion, he's in lust with her at best, if you ask me. Especially as, again, as you said, if he never talks to her, we kind of have to assume that he just thinks she's beautiful, which, fine, this is Keira Knightley we're talking about, and has therefore become obsessed with her. Not fine. But this just makes him creepy. Period. Full stop. Plus, those cue cards, my wasted heart will love you forever and all. What is he doing with that? Is he trying to make her feel bad? Because I think that's what he's doing. And honestly, no, Mark seems like the type who is going to murder Peter or Juliet or maybe yeah. Just both of them someday if he doesn't yep. Get his shit together like really damn soon.
Yeah. So I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a minute. Before I understood the fact that I had ADHD, I didn't know the difference between being like infatuated with somebody and it just being like a hyper-focused thing. Because you'll get hyper-focused on things and you just kind of sink that. In yeah and you sink into something and then you kind of realize after a bit where you're like, wait a minute, I'm not into this person. I actually learned that from fucking TikTok, because I went on TikTok and it was this girl saying, hey, guess what, you're not in love with her, you're just hyper focused. And I was like, wow, that yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So I get it. I had a tendency when I was growing up that I would like somebody at a distance. I didn't want to say anything. And it wasn't just because they were like beautiful and it wasn't because they were like good looking, but there was something that was interesting about them to me. So you get very infatuated, but understanding how my brain works, it's like, okay, you just found them interesting. It wasn't that you were in love with them. You were madly in love with them. You just found them interesting and you wanted to know more about them. If you have a little piece of cake and the cake tastes good, you want to eat the whole fucking cake. So if there's little things in a person where it's like, man, look at the way they dress. They're so sophisticated. Or it's things that appeal to you. Maybe they're into the same obscure bullshit that you're into. And you're like, oh, man, that's the only other person I know who's into this thing as much as I am. And then you just zone in on it where it's like, oh, my gosh, this is the absolute love of my life. And no, it's not. It's just nice to be in company with somebody. They're interesting. You just want to get to know more.
I feel that hardcore. That said, not to like, this is like a break from that discussion, but I do have to mention this. He rings the doorbell, right? Juliet's like, I'm going to go get it. So she goes down and he's like, who is it? Mark has the key card. It's, hey, it's Carol Singers. And she says, it's Carol Singers. So apparently Peter can't hear this fucking boombox he has that is playing like tinny recording of like some Christmas song. That would not fool anyone if they could actually even just sort of hear it. I get it. He's upstairs, rightfully, like he couldn't hear it, but that's always fucking annoyed me. Like, what the fuck? Nobody, that's not Carol Singers.
Well, maybe just ask, hey, why is my wife gone for so long?
Oh, I told her to get rid of the Carol Singers.
And she's just apparently like sitting there. No, yeah. Exactly.
Seriously, this whole storyline is so awkward and it goes nowhere. And I know you had some thoughts on it going nowhere. So
this story is probably one of the worst in all of them. However, I will say this. This story is probably the one I related to the most. Now, I would have done things very differently than this guy did. But again, you can see where this guy is more of a sense of hyperfixation as opposed to anything else. So yeah, he was mean to her, but maybe like he was just fucking cold, right? Because he's protecting himself. I've been in those situations where I've been like with people who were friends of friends and we all hung out together. And I'm like, I'm keeping a distance from this person. So they thought, oh, well, he's just cold. It's because I actually really like you and you're in a situation and I'm not here to fuck up anybody's fucking situation. Now, I would have been the person that maybe would have gotten caught, right? Like, it's been like, oh my gosh, all these videos or these drawings or some shit that you're fucking doing are all, they all look like they're based on me. And it's like, well, okay, yeah.
I'm going to interrupt you for a second here, which I normally would never do. But let's be very clear that he recorded their whole wedding and then made himself like a highlights reel. And that's what that's she found.
That's yeah, okay.
Fucking creepy.
Yeah, so that is not something that that's not the path I would have taken. That would have been more like an internal kind of like thing, not so much like, oh, I filmed everything, you know, and it's just that comes off as definitely kind of a serial killer and kind of weird.
Well, and also like if you're going to do that, why would you label the tape Mark and Juliet's wedding or whatever he labeled it? Why wouldn't you label it like personal porn or like something that she would never he never thought that she would come to his house, but label it something. I don't even give it a code name for fuck's sake.
My thing is this, I guess the part that I just wouldn't understand is like, why would you keep it? Just get rid of it. You're going to torture yourself to death? Look, it's great. Take a picture. Get a little screenshot from one of the videos that you like the best and just put it in a, you know, in a scrapbook or something. You know, are you going to fucking torture yourself? It's fucking weird. But look, and in the end, I would have had no problem admitting to whatever person and saying, yeah, no, I totally did. And that's why I was cold, because I was just into you and it's not a big deal. I'm not showing up at the fucker's fucking doorstep with holding up fucking cards. And when you see him walking away with the cards, people had to have walked past him and been like, oh shit, I wonder what he's talking about. I can see the first card.
And the
I can see the first card. And the like, oh dude. Yeah. And I don't know what the end goal is there. And then again, I know that we have to separate from reason, because the movie is not about reason. Yeah. It's about love actually is, right? That's what the movie's about. However, what would have happened if her husband answered the fucking door?
What would have happened if he had come downstairs and be like, girl, why are you taking so long?
Exactly. Exactly.
And then she runs after him and kisses him on the lips. Don't even get me started.
Yeah.
That's a whole fucking other mess that I don't even want to get into. So I'm just going to end this with, not to mention, they don't even go here. Here being the Christmas concert, none of these three attend that end of the movie Christmas concert, as far as we can tell. And yes, there are other characters who don't show up at the concert either. Mm-hmm. But it seems like their story, Peter, Juliet, and Mark, is supposed to be one of like the top five, if not top four, plot lines. And in that case, them not being at the concert makes the whole thing fall even more flat already is.
Because they weren't really connected to anybody. It was just weird. And
honestly, it seems like they only exist as a connector or additional connector to some of the subplots.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to need everyone to stand behind the yellow line as the subplots train comes into the station, everybody. All right, we're going to go ahead and look at some of those for a moment. The subplots, that is. Ladies and gentlemen, everyone stand behind the yellow line until the train comes to a complete stop. The first stop on this trip is Sarah and Carl. Sarah and Carl is like a weird one for me, because I feel like this had the potential to be an actual love story. Mm-hmm. Everybody else, it's easy to fall in love when everything is kind of perfect. When there's no consequence, there's no baggage there. It's just cute and whatever. However, Sarah has her brother that she takes care of. Did they ever say what he has in it? I don't think they ever did, right?
No. He is just a person with a mental illness. As not a doctor, I would guess it's like schizophrenia, but they don't ever say. There are some also like things about that as well that they don't. Yeah.
They don't really tackle it. Yeah. And again, this is like, okay, so to me, this is like such a trope when it comes to like guys. Why do the sexy guys look like they haven't taken a shower in 2 weeks? I just always see that. I like to pamper myself. I like to make myself look pretty. I like to make myself get, and like every guy, it's like it has messy hair, kind of not shaven, and then looking like they've been sweating all fucking day. Don't answer, because we're not going to have that conversation.
I mean, listen, he's not my type, but also look at him. Like, look at him.
No, he's got Crispin Cole vibes. Okay. And I don't like him.
Well, okay. No, for anybody listening to this who has not watched House of the Dragon, we're talking about an incel motherfucker. Looks wise, yes, he has Crispin Cole vibes. However, Carl does actually seem like a really good guy. It's hard for me to know what to say about this particular storyline. And again, this number four of ours, this toot toot, here come the awkward subplots train. There are two separate storylines that we're going to cover in this thing we hate about this movie. First being this one. And it's hard for me to know what to say about it because it's probably more sad than awkward because I understand Sarah's love for her brother and desire to care for her brother who is living with a mental illness. But at what point do you put up some boundaries or shoot even like one boundary so that you can have some happiness yourself? Mm-hmm. Because I'm of the mindset that you can't truly take care of someone in a way that is best for them. Mm-hmm. If you yourself are lonely, possibly even miserably so. Not to mention, how does this not affect her job when he apparently calls her constantly while she's working as well? The thing with Carl, when they first start hooking up, mm-hmm. And just to like, I want to say, I got to give Laura Linney props. They go to the holiday party. She comes home. Mm-hmm. He's with her. Like they're making out for a second. And she's like, give me a second. And she like has that super excited dance on the mm-hmm. stairs. Oh my God. It's so fun and her. Perfect and lovely. Oh God. Mm-hmm. I love Laura Linney. And also she goes upstairs to like clean her room. She like kisses the teddy bear and puts it on. And it's so fucking cute. That's something I would do, by the way. But Carl is actually super understanding of the whole situation. And it feels fucking weird to me that, I don't know, he knows. He's worked with her for years. He sees mm-hmm. her take these calls. He knows what's going on. I don't know. It's just weird to me that she doesn't get to have happiness. I understand this is a very difficult situation and that her brother comes first for her, which is understandable to an extent, mm-hmm. but I don't know. I understand it and hate it at the same time. And I will get into some thoughts on that a little bit later.
I just feel like this story was the biggest missed opportunity in the entire movie, because I wouldn't say that Carl came off as annoyed when everything was going on, but probably just more confused than anything else. Because my first initial reaction was like, oh man, the guy just looks fucking annoyed, right? And I just didn't like him from the beginning because he reminds me of old Crispin Cole.
That's not fair though, because he really is actually very nice about it. Like when her brother first calls her, like he's very understanding. No. She's the one who pushes him away. And I don't know. I feel like there's like some world where she's like, listen, maybe we can't have sex tonight, but do you want to just hang out for a bit? I'll take this call. Like we'll have mm-hmm. some coffee or because they don't even know each other that well. We'll have some coffee or tea. We'll chat. Maybe she takes him to meet her brother. I don't know.
Yeah. And that's why I say this is like the biggest missed opportunity. When the phone calls started coming in, they should have wrote it to where he would have been like, hey, do you want me to make some coffee, order some food, or like, you know, we'll just like chill, like whatever. And then it could have continued with, maybe the story builds up to where he's meeting the brother and all this kind of stuff. This is the only one that I felt like actually had something going for that just didn't go anywhere. I mean, because even the stories in this are about love, and this just seems more like it kind of came off as more of a fucking hookup than it did anything else to me when I watched it.
I'll have some thoughts on that in mm-hmm. a later point, but regardless, it's awkward. But it does serve to show us the basics of Sarah's story. Mm-hmm. However, it does not go anywhere. So let's move on to the second stop, maybe.
I hope you all enjoyed the first stop. Everyone who just joined on the train, get ready because you're in for it. Second stop on the awkward subplots train is John and Judy. Kind of pointless aside, but while it's not surprising, it is annoying that there doesn't appear to be any clarification in Love Actually regarding what type of movie John and Judy are sex scene stand-ins for. If you go on IMDb, the summary of the Love Actually just vaguely calls it a film. And while I found a brief back and forth on Reddit where some people think it's a regular movie and some people think it's a porn, a couple of old articles refer to it either being as a porn or an erotic drama. None of these are official sources.
Personally, I have to go with it being a regular quote unquote film based on John's comment about a previous job where he was a stand-in. First of all, this is hilarious. Martin Freeman being a stand-in for Brad Pitt, but he was a stand-in for Brad Pitt on the set of 7 Years in Tibet. Yes, there are some articles online that are like, yeah, they were stand-ins for a porn film or whatever. I don't think that was it though. I don't think so.
When you had mentioned it being like more of like a normal film, I was like, I feel that that would make more sense, you know? But also, I guess the part that I had to kind of like think about was like, oh, okay, so they're just probably just filming their midsection because they are having a conversation in the middle of doing this. And I assume they don't want that on camera, but
This whole thing is very awkward. This is one that I have a hard time with because I feel like there are some reasons that are obvious why it's awkward. The fact that we don't really know what they're standing in for or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the fact that these are the only nude scenes in the movie. But I don't think the reasons why it's awkward is that they're nude. It's more just like they're both just so cute. And you're just like, oh, this is awkward because they're doing these really physical things with each other. And they're both naked. And I don't know. Either way, the good thing is that nothing bad comes of it. This is probably the purest, simplest.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Yep. Plot. Yep. It's awkward. It's awkward as fuck. But it's the purest, simplest plot. And I think the biggest reason why it's awkward is that in the like 1 month later at Heathrow scene, these two people who just went on their first date right before Christmas are already engaged.
Already engaged.
Well, okay then.
But I will say this, at least their story had like an arc, like a complete arc.
Yes. And they were both very sweet, cute. Like I said, they seem like two very nice people. John made it very clear that there was no pressure on her to go on a date with him, which was great. Probably the actual worst thing that happens is Judy telling him, "All I want for Christmas is you." Okay, no, she doesn't say it like that. She just says, "All I want for Christmas is you."
Yeah.
Which is just the cheesy sort of cringe.
And his response was even better. He literally just said, "Thank you."
Yeah.
And I was like, ooh, yeah. When you tell someone, like when you show someone like emotion or like feeling like that, and they say, "Thank you," that's not even a red flag. That is a iron dome. That is a wall. You know, that is literally the wall that divides Russia from the West, right? Like that is it. The iron curtain. There's no going through that. Time to go home.
This storyline was really only part of the cringy, you know, awkward subplots train because we don't know what the fuck they're doing.
No, yeah.
But also it's cute. It's cute. More positive than negative.
Yeah. The more I think about it, it's actually really well done because even though there is like the stand-ins for like sex scenes, watching them, you kind of almost forget about that. To where it's like, oh, well, that's not the point. The point is like, look at how these people kind of meet each other. That's an interesting way that they met each other and how that's evolving. By the time she was like, oh, I'm engaged, I kind of forgot what they did for a living. I was just like, you know, oh, yeah. So I don't know. I think they did pretty good with them.
When I first saw this movie, I thought the Heathrow scenes at the end were like a year later.
That's what I thought. Yeah, when I watched it.
So when I found out it was a month later, I was like, oh, that's weird. That's but okay, guys, you do you. Mm-hmm. We're going to remain in subplot territory for number 5, a.k.a. I'll take worst subplot for 1,000, Alex. We first meet this subplot's subject, Colin Frissell, at Peter and Juliet's wedding. Which Sarah attends, and Colin is connected to the Jack and Judy story through their mutual friend, Tony. He's friends with Tony, and Tony is like a production assistant in the Jack and Judy stuff that we just talked about. Mm-hmm. But this subplot really deserved its own separate track. Yeah. See what I did there? Because Colin is simply fucking awful. His character makes no sense in regards to the rest of the movie or the rest of the so-called love stories. He's just like, I'm not getting laid in England, so I'll go to America. And then he like rents out his flat, shows up at Tony's flat, and is like, I got a backpack full of condoms, gotta stay here for a night before I fly to Milwaukee. Okay, I'm sorry. Milwaukee. This is 2003. The internet fucking exists. You're buying a plane ticket to America. I can tell you for fucking sure, as somebody who traveled to Europe four times between 2000 and 2011, that Milwaukee is not the airport that is cheapest to fly to from London. So he bought a random ticket to a random city in Wisconsin. This makes
sense. So that's one of those, like, he has a map of America and he's throwing a dart, you know, and he's like, we're going to boom, Milwaukee right there. I'm sure Milwaukee's got great things there.
Yeah. Not talking shit about Milwaukee.
Not at all. But that's not what generally someone from overseas would say, that's where I'm going to visit. Just as much as us, right? Like, we wouldn't say, okay, I'm going to visit this small village, you know, in the south part of like Japan somewhere. And there's like 300 people there. Like, that's what I'm going to go do, right? No, where are we going? We're going to Tokyo. We're going to Osaka. We're going to Kyoto, right? Just like somebody from over there might say, well, I'm going to go to New York. I'm going to go to Los Angeles. I'm going to go to Miami.
First of all, there is no way there was a direct flight from fucking Heathrow to Milwaukee.
No.
Negative. Absolutely not.
Negative.
Why did not you go to New York, Chicago, fucking Charlotte, North Carolina, maybe?
He would have absolutely had a layover in Atlanta, Georgia. That is the layover capital of the world. That's where he would have wound up for 2 hours before he went there. But yeah, direct flight. No, dude, that's what rich people do. Rich people can take a flight all the way out there. Not normal.
No, but that's the thing. I doubt there is one that exists. I guarantee you, especially in 2003, that he flew from London to Chicago to Milwaukee. Some nonsense like that. Then he gets to America.
Oh, man. Oh, man. God bless America. I didn't know. I had no idea. I lived here my entire life. I had no idea.
You don't
idea.
Have a British accent, Manny. I lose.
Okay, but I have a Miami accent. That should get me something, you know? Like, come on now.
Listen, I know this is supposed to be a parody, but he gets off the plane in Milwaukee, supposedly, and he's like, take me to the closest bar. He ends up at some dive bar.
Yeah.
And he immediately meets, is it three hot girls? Three. It's just three at this
point. Three hot girls, because the fourth one hasn't shown up.
Basically, he meets these three super fucking hot girls. Mm-hmm. And they're like so attracted to him because he has a British accent. Mm-hmm. And they invite him back to their house. And they're like, oh, they only have one bed for several people and no couch. They can't afford pajamas.
So you can't afford pajamas. Why are you in a bar? Why are you buying drinks at a bar?
Yes. If you're sleeping in a fucking apartment with one bed, why are you in a bar?
Allow me to just kind of rewrite the scene here. All right, guys. This is a little interlude on the train. We're not making a stop for a little bit. Everyone come into the dining cart. We're going to have some whiskey.
Yes.
Okay. Here's my take on this, okay? Here's what happens. He goes there, and then these girls are obviously scam artists. I mean, you saw they were throwing themselves out there. Hey, no problem. Hey, let me get you a drink, sir. The guy wakes up, no clothes, you know, his money's gone. He's like, oh my God, I'm stranded here. What the hell am I going to do? So then he gets help from people. I don't know. He gets some help, and then maybe that person is like has a cousin or like a sister, and it feels bad for them. And then they connect, and he's like, man, I went to the United States to like get laid, but I found love instead. And then he flies back, and maybe he's married now to her, you know, because obviously it only takes a month to get engaged to somebody. And then boom, his life is like, again, missed opportunity.
But I mean, again, like then he comes back. He's in the end scene. And first of all, neither of the girls that he brings back to England with him are the girls that we saw in the bar.
No.
Because he brings back Shannon Elizabeth for himself, which, holla, American Pie.
Yeah, exactly.
And
so it all links together.
Yeah. And Denise Richards for his friend Tony.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, this is her sister. She's real friendly. And she like immediately walks up and starts making out with him because that's how American girls are, y'all.
Yep, that's how it is, dude.
Oh my God.
Maybe I'm just overly paranoid, but if a girl did that, I'd be like, oh my gosh, call the ambulance. I've been drugged. I know they put something on me, like they're trying to pass me out so you can rob me. And then it's like, dude, wait, who wrote this movie again? Is this how you think American girls are?
Well,
it's bad.
Yeah. You want to move on to number six?
Oh my God.
Because unfortunately, okay, we do. We have to move on.
Unfortunately, we have to move on to something that makes even less sense and is possibly, nay, probably even more problematic, as the sixth thing we hate about Love Actually is power dynamics and actual communication. What are those? We don't need those. Unnecessary. Cut it off the budget. We don't need it. You know, those are nice to haves, not need to haves. Okay. While there are a couple of relationships / situationships that fall under a problematic power dynamics umbrella. In this case, we're talking about Jamie, the writer, and his housekeeper, Aurelia, because not only does she work for him, they don't even speak the same language.
Listen, I love Colin Firth so much. But regardless of how attracted these two people might be to each other, and sure, him acting like a sad, bumbling idiot around her most of the time might be endearing, right? Yeah. Okay, it might be. Up until the last minutes with him, she seems to mostly just lob insults his way in Portuguese. And okay, Manny, quick aside, I have to ask, is this a mousy plain girl takes off her glasses and lets down her hair and becomes gorgeous situation, a la She's All That, only of course in this case she's taking off clothes, not glasses?
Yeah, that's exactly what this is. This is just the PG-13 version of that. You know, oh yeah, no, she's such a nerd. And then like the dress comes off and you're like, oh man, she's got a great body. Hold on a second. She's not a nerd. If they would have presented the situation a little differently, it would have been fine. You see someone, maybe they just seem a little too proper, but then you see a little ankle tattoo and you're like, oh shit, all right, nice. You know, I have tattoos too. That's awesome. You're a little wild just like me, huh?
In this situation, sure. Fine. I will agree to believe, I guess, that they fell in lust with each other again. But in love? No. And yet, Jamie, the writer, after like 2 weeks with this girl, goes back to England, learns a kind of unbelievable amount of Portuguese in at best 2 weeks, but I don't think it was even that long.
Which is not an easy language to learn.
No. And then he rushes back to France to not just like present himself as a suitor, like a simple like, hey, I care about you. I would like to spend time with you. No. He asks her to marry him. Literally, I hung out with you for like a few weeks and we don't even speak the same language, but I'm going to ask your dad if I can marry you.
But guys, remember, little disclaimer while we're on the train here, guys, please keep your hands to yourself while we're driving. And also remember, this movie is about love, okay? And it's important that you do not ask questions. So the fact of the matter is that they love each other because they were in the same room for more than 20 minutes. And that's all it takes in this film, guys. All right. Sit down. Shut up. Continue.
The only other thing I have to say about this is, plus, why is Aurelia's Portuguese family written like they're from a third world country or possibly even another planet?
They were like going to sell her off or something. The girl's like, oh, he's going to sell her off.
And yeah, like, into slavery.
It's like, I'm sorry, guys.
Also, there is some fat shaming in this, which we're going to get into the actual fat shaming issues in a little bit. But in this case, like, I think that the father calls his other daughter Miss Dunkin' Donuts 2003, which also, like, why is a Portuguese man calling his daughter Miss Dunkin'? Something about that feels weird.
Like, and you would think since they're in the third world part of Portugal, that they would even know what a Dunkin' Donuts is. And you're right. That insult is a very like Northeastern insult.
Well, the Jamie and Aurelia storyline makes literally no sense. In what world is some dude meeting? Like, I get he just got his heart broken, but you meet this housekeeper, again, power dynamics, and you're like, oh, she's kind of in my way and annoying. And she's like literally talking shit about him in Portuguese all the time, which good for her, by the way, no judgment on her. And then she happens to lift his coffee cup off of like a bunch of pages of some book he's writing, and they fly into the lake, and she strips off her clothes so slowly and in her like matching lilac underwear.
Yeah.
My underwear never match my bra. So does that mean I don't get to find love in France?
No. Yeah. What it means is that if you're in that situation, you need to be like, oh, wait, no, hold on. I'm just going to, let me just get it from here. I'm not going to jump in.
No. I only wear matching shit when I know I'm going to get some. So. Oh my God. But also, this whole movie takes place over 5 weeks. By the way, this is the person that found out that his brother was fucking his girlfriend. Which, first of all, like, why did he even go back home? He went back home and he went to his family thing. And then he's like, ooh, never mind. And all of his nieces and nephews were like, I hate Uncle Jamie. And it was like, how about you hate his brother? Was it one of your fathers? Like, I don't know what the situation. There's zero explanation here.
This is not the first time that we've mentioned on this train ride about it being only a few weeks, right? Is this movie about love or is it just about hyperfixation? I'm curious because I think I've kind of lost the plot here a little bit where I'm like, wait a minute. Now, at least they allowed him to like mess up. 50% of my family is like Portuguese, but they don't speak Portuguese, but I'm familiar with it. When I hear it, I know what it is. So I thought they did a good job of it. Like, okay, well, yeah, he's mispronouncing that. And is that what he's actually trying to say or what they wrote there in the subtitles? I don't know. I'm not that fluent with it.
I get learning some Portuguese and going back and being like, hey, let's have a relationship. Let's explore this.
Again, missed opportunity. It would have been cute if they dated for more than or knew each other for more than 4 weeks. And part of their dating was them teaching each other their own language. That would have been fucking great. That's what I would assume what love actually is. Great.
I mean, listen, like this could have been a whole movie on its own, but we're going to move on because I suppose we might as well continue on the tack of relationships with power dynamics with number 7. In the words of David the Prime Minister, would we call her chubby? I got to begin this with, of course, it is questionable that the freaking prime minister, whose name is David, just David, seriously, they never give him a last name, is crushing on Natalie, who is one of his staff members. Granted, she is also into him, and he at least is never inappropriate with her. So props to him for that. Props.
He tries to keep his distance, too. You can see it.
Yeah, yeah. That said, while fat shaming occurs elsewhere in Love Actually, let's be real, pretty much all of our complaints with this relationship stem from the fact that Natalie herself is constantly fat shamed. As we get into this, I am going to state the following as nothing more than simple fact. This is not an opinion on or judgment of anyone's weight. Natalie's included. The fact is, she is not as slim / skinny / thin as the other younger women in this movie. We're talking about like Mia, Juliet, who is played by Keira Knightley, etc. Yeah. I don't think we need to have a discussion about this fact. What matters is that while, again, several characters are fat shamed in this movie, it's at its most egregious with Natalie. Throughout Love Actually, we see 1, her explain that her boyfriend dumped her because she gained weight. 2, she's referred to as chubby multiple times. 3, she's described as having a sizable ass and huge thighs. Like, what the fuck even? I can't. Christ, even her own father calls her plumpy, and it is not simply an endearing nickname kind of way. And then, despite how the rest of David and Natalie's blossoming relationship seems pretty sweet, when they reunite at Heathrow at the end of the movie and she jumps into his arms, he straight up says, God, you weigh a lot. which, okay, I will give it this. Maybe that is a private joke between them, but I don't know. It's still hard to stomach based on gestures, everything else that came before. It's hard to address all of this because I refuse to cotton to like fat shaming or body shaming. Anybody, do you have anything to say about this? Because I honestly think it's just like the whole thing speaks for itself. It doesn't matter how she looked. I was talking to one of my friends, Becca, about this, and she sent me an article titled something like, "How dare they have fat shamed this actress in this movie, this character in this movie?" And Richard Curtis, who wrote the movie, apparently in like 2023, which like too little too late, my dude. He was like, "Oh, I didn't know. I didn't mean it to be mean." Nah, dude, it was always fucking mean. Like, just because it was quote unquote okay then and it's not okay now, it was always fucking mean. Fuck you. You can apologize for the things that you did that you regret, but he didn't apologize for it in a way that was like, "I regret it." He apologized in that, "Oh, well, back then I didn't understand. Like, I didn't do it in a malicious manner." And it's like, how the fuck is fat shaming not always in a malicious manner? I'm so mad about that article. I didn't look into it more, but I hope people fucking ripped him a new one for that shit.
Yeah. And like, especially for like now, right? So those kind of jokes, yes, were they a product of the time? Yeah, absolutely. Because when you look at any of those movies, you always see that kind of stuff. To say that it was just a product of the time and that's it and not apologize for it. Like if it was me and I made the movie, I would have been like, yeah, you know what? That was malicious. And it came from a time where maliciousness was acceptable. Because it was okay to say things like that. Does it make it right? No, it doesn't make it right, but that's what was happening.
I could go off about this for like a year, but do we want to move on to number eight? Because otherwise I will. Yeah.
Yeah. The train does have an end of the line. As we move on, there's one relationship we haven't talked about yet. Though in this case, the relationship itself isn't the problem. In fact, it isn't any problem. So instead, number eight on our list is Dirty Old Men Are Funny. Or not. This is probably a short one because we only have 2 points to touch in on. First being when Billy Mack is asked who his best shag ever was, and he quickly responds, "Britney Spears." And when the radio host is like, "Wow," Billy literally snorts and then continues, "No, only kidding. She was rubbish."
Yeah, Britney Spears was like 21 when this movie was filmed. So there's an age difference thing here, but also the usual sexualizing of Britney compounded with him, even if it's just jokingly talking shit about her sexually, just gross.
Yep, gross.
The other part of this, Dirty Old Men, there's the American president hitting on Natalie, sexually assaulting her.
Yeah, that's what it is. Call it for what it is.
Yeah, and thankfully this isn't treated as a joke, but even good old David, the prime minister, who we never have a last name for, asks for Natalie to be moved from her position to one, away from him after it happens. And that's just never sat well for me. It feels kind of victim blamey.
Mm-hmm. It does.
"Oh, I caught you in the prime minister and I'm sexually attracted to you too. So like, go away."
Even if it didn't happen with the other person, but just if you have to remove somebody because you're sexually attracted to them, yeah, that's a problem with you, not with them. Yeah. So you shouldn't be doing that. And if you can't control it, guess what, Mr. Minister, Mr. David Minister, maybe you shouldn't, maybe you shouldn't be doing what you're doing. Maybe you shouldn't be the fucking prime minister.
I think that like my issue with it stands with obviously the American president, who is played by Billy Bob Thornton and is clearly supposed to be a weird amalgamation of George W. and Clinton. That's a weird combination to insist upon, but okay. David was already interested in her, but it's only after that thing happens that he's like, "Move her." So that's what I don't like about it.
Yeah, because it's victim blaming and it's him using his position of power to like, do something like that. And that's like fucked up.
Sure. Later he takes it back and they become cute. But do they though? God, you weigh a lot.
Dude. Bro.
Well, number nine, in case it wasn't clear throughout our discussion of many of the previous things we hate, we have to look at this from a wider angle because it simply deserves its own mention. Number nine is women in agency? Not in this film.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps this is unconscious bias. The men in this film have a lot of love against all odds sort of stories. Basically, all of them get some sort of conclusion, even if it's not like a happy one per se, to their relationship woes or pursuits. For instance, I understand why Sarah's story is about familial love, the fact that it seems as if she'll likely never get to experience romantic love of her own is just like not fair. No one is going to change my mind on that, especially as, let's say, Creepy Mark at least gets a conclusion to his stupid story. And then, of course, Karen doesn't get an obvious conclusion to her story either. It appears at the very end that she's likely keeping things amicable for the kids. But my God, if that's the case, we should have had to see Harry actually be honest with her instead of playing the end of worst game, which is what he plays when confronted. I want to know for sure that she made the choice to tell him to bugger off.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, there's Juliet. Oh, Juliet. We hardly... Okay, no, we absolutely don't at all know ye.
No, at all.
We don't know anything about Juliet other than that she gets married to Peter and Mark is in love with her. She's not really a character so much as...
No, she's just a
device to show us poor, sad, creepy Mark and his weird, gross, unrequited love.
Yep, I didn't like it. It was dumb. Now I'm going to say this is that, you know, I'm a little sucker for Keira Knightley. I've always liked her. So it was sweet because I like, you know, seeing her pretty face and, you know, and the way she talks and all that kind of stuff. Fantastic. Great. But I feel like there was a lot of people in this film that were wasted because let's face facts. They have a lot of really big name people in here. A lot of big name people that were just kind of like.
Well, to be fair, a lot of them weren't big name in 2003.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point, actually. I feel like in this movie, I know that you write also, right? So I don't know if you've done this. I've done this before with a few things that I've attempted to write, where I come up with a good situation, but I don't know how to fit it into a story. And I feel like a lot of this movie is that. It's like, okay, these are love situations. Maybe the point of it is that it's like kind of a nothing comes from it kind of situation. They can't fit it in anything else, so it's like... You remember that one movie we watched where I kept saying I felt like it was all the deleted scenes of like 90s movies and they mashed it together into like one film? That's what I feel like about this, where I'm like,
which one was that? Can't Hardly Wait? Or
Can't Hardly Wait. It was Can't Hardly Wait. I feel like this is kind of the same thing almost, but like from like a writing perspective. Because how I would write is that there was these scenes I would want, and then I would kind of write them all out and I would figure out ways to link them together. So they were kind of like my anchor of like, okay, how does it get from here to here? This is what's going to happen. This is what's going to happen. And I feel like with these stories, there was no way to really link them aside from the fact that this is what love actually is. And that's it.
You're killing me. You're fucking killing me.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is our last stop on the train. Please put your tray to the upright position.
That's a plane, though. Upright position. They don't care about that on trains.
So what do they say on trains? I don't
even
know what they say.
They don't care. I've been on so many trains.
They're just like, toot, toot, motherfucker.
Yeah, toot, toot, motherfucker. It's our 10th and final stop.
Okay, and last but certainly not least, the 10th and final thing we hate about this movie. It's no longer London. It's Hetero City. Hetero City reminds me, I feel like that should be an expansion pack for Cyberpunk, right? Like, it sounds like a Cyberpunk. Instead of like whatever city, what is it, Night City? You guys been to Night City, now it's time for
hetero city where everyone is straight and boring.
Exactly, where everyone is straight and boring.
Exactly. Okay, so yes, it was 2003, but also this takes place in a major city in Europe, and every single couple who made the cut into the movie, that is, was a hetero couple. Yeah. I didn't know that there was other
things. I didn't either. It makes me so frustrated that apparently there was a single LGBTQIA plus storyline that was cut from the script. It was like somebody from the school had like a wife who was dying of cancer. I mean, it was sad, but yeah, Richard Curtis, the writer, even admitted regretting losing it, which makes me feel like it was the movie people being like, can't have gay people. Can't have those gay people.
Yeah. And which is dumb because, it, you know, it would have been a good time to have something like that in there, you know, and it wasn't like it was like a taboo thing. I mean, I guess it kind of was in a sense, but not like the way it was back in the 90s and stuff.
But also, yeah. I mean, when Billy Mack shows up at his manager's apartment, he's like, hey, the person that I love is actually you. And he's like, 10 minutes with Elton John and you're a flaming gay. And it's like, whoa. Yeah. But that said, all of that said, yes, this movie is so fucking hetero. And I know it was 2003, but also, come on, guys. They had a storyline and they cut it. If it wasn't for that, I probably would have just passed over the heteroness of it because it was 2003. But knowing that they had an LGBTQ storyline and they're no, not going to do that.
I think they were just trying to play it safe.
But let's call this girl fat all the time and have this creepy as fuck guy be in love with his best friend's wife. Okay.
Yeah, there was a lot of
not to mention the Portuguese shit, which was like,
yeah,
I'll be honest. I don't know. Was it racist? It was bad no matter what.
It made it seem like I couldn't decide at first. I had to really listen to the language to understand, be like, oh, okay, there it's Portuguese because like there are some things that I can understand from it. So I was looking at it. I was like, oh, because at first I thought it was like, are they from like Kazakhstan? Is this like some kind of Russian, something off the Eastern Bloc? And no, it wasn't. And I was just like, okay. Dude, maybe in the 1600s, but it's not. This has been a train ride, hasn't it? As usual.
Toot.
All that said, now it's time for us to dig deep for a few things to add to our these are all that list.
I think I love the awkward broship between washed up rock star Billy Mack and his manager, and kind of everything about that storyline, honestly. Though it could have been more fun if he didn't make, you know, rude comments about his manager's looks or weight, and instead this turned into the one like non-hetero relationship that came out of this movie. I love the broship. Give me two men who will profess their love for each other and hug each other in like a platonic way.
And even if the other guy like wasn't into it, you saw how it was played off. It was just like, and he's like, hey, let's just get shit faced and let's just whatever. Yeah. It wasn't like a, ew, oh my God, I can't believe you like guys. It was just very, hey man, that's cool. Not my thing, but let's get wasted anyway. You know?
No, like, they were cute. Well, and also like when Billy Mack, the way he's like, it turns out the person I love was you. Yeah. He's very ridiculous about it. And his manager is like, oh, he like doesn't expect that sort of appreciation. I love it. I'm here for it.
That was one of the cooler love story parts that, yeah, they didn't hook up, but it was good. Yeah. And that actually was a very good arc because it literally starts from the beginning to the very end of the film.
Well, right. And as much as I would have loved like a gay love story, I also respect the whole just broship. Men should be able to be affectionate with each other. And I think agree. That is what this relationship shows. Mm-hmm. Now, my second one, Daniel and Sam's relationship. Up until it is revealed that Daniel is Sam's stepfather, you obviously assume that he's like his
biological.
But then knowing that Sam is his stepson makes everything about their relationship even sweeter. I gotta take a personal breath for a second, because even when Sam admits that he is in love and Daniel asks how she or he feels about Sam, I don't know. I've always thought their relationship was so great, despite their sad storyline, or at least the sad beginning of it. But also, being a stepmom has put it even more into perspective. There's dumb shit and weird shit about their storyline too, but Daniel, his devotion to his stepson after his wife dies, that's all I'm gonna say.
It's Christmas, girl. You gotta let it all come out. You know? In this train, in our train, there is anger, there is love, there is tears, there's everything. All right, you guys came for the full Monty here.
What about you? Your positives.
Bill Nye, I love the guy. He's a great actor, and I really liked his laugh and snort thing. He does that a lot. That's like kind of a thing that he does, and it's so fucking endearing. Like, I fucking love him. He does it in like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy also, right? Because he was in that film and he did it. He's fantastic. I love seeing him, you know, on any level. It was just fucking great. And yeah, and that bro like relationship. And I just thought it was like really cool that he confesses his love and the other guy doesn't really seem to be into it. He's just like, oh, well, okay. And then the way they react to each other is like, all right, well, let's just get fucked up. I love that. It's like, yeah, okay, why does shit have to be weird? Let's go get fucking roasted anyway. Yeah. And we're gonna have a good night regardless. And Colin Firth, it's great to see him in it, even though his story was kind of like weird. I'm definitely a Masterpiece Theater kid. Anytime I see someone show up from Masterpiece Theater stuff, because, you know, I used to watch those movies even when I was like younger. I don't know. I was very much into period pieces. I was a weird kid growing up, and that's what I was into. You know, I liked those things, and he was in a lot of them. Anything else good about this movie? It was cool. I saw Keira Knightley in it. There was that guy who was from Walking Dead. That was cool. Even though I wasn't really into Walking Dead, I only watched like a season of it. And the one who's married to Juliet, I can't remember what the actor's name
is. Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Yeah. He's fantastic too. Like, I first saw him in that Serenity movie and he was like really awesome. And I love his presence. Yeah, that was about it. Was there any trains in it? I don't think there was any trains in it, right?
Not physical, literal trains. No, but
yeah, no. But like ones that, did anyone, no one rode in a train? No, 0 out of 10.
If we're rating this on a scale of 1 to 10 Zach Morris's, with 10 being the most cringy, I'm going to rate it like a 6.
Yeah, I was going to give it a 5 or a 6 too. And I'll tell you why. When I go and get like a taco bowl, everyone is going to hate me for this when I say this. And I do apologize ahead of time, guys. However, the conductor is still, you know, hasn't stopped the train yet. So you're all stuck. You're just going to have to listen to it. Okay. And I'm not picky when I order food, right? Like when I order food, if something is wrong, I never send it back. I'm just like, oh, I'll just figure it out. And I'm very shy when it comes to those things. Somebody can completely mess up my order and put chocolate sprinkles on it, which I hate chocolate. And I will still do my best to try to move them out of the way and just eat around them. Okay. Cause I'm one of those people. Okay. So you go and I go and I get the taco stuff, right? Oh, great. It's got all the things I like. But I strictly told them, I don't want any guacamole on it. I hate guacamole. And they put it in there. But here's the problem. It's not that they put it in there and I can dig around it. It's that they mixed the whole thing together. Now, it's a conundrum. What do I do? Do I return it and I go be a Todd or go be a Karen, you know? And then maybe they spit in my food, you know? Or maybe they mixed the guacamole in there because maybe the person thought, hey, you know what? This person really might like it. And they're trying to go above and beyond to make me like it. So now I'm in a weird conundrum. So in this movie, there's things in it that are the guacamole. And there's other things that are like the beans and the rice and all these kinds of things where I'm like, oh, I like these aspects to it. It wasn't a total disaster because there were just things about it. Like I really liked Liam Neeson's thing. I liked Bill Nye's thing. I liked different aspects to it. And not only that, it was cool to just see people in it. Even though that there was people that their storylines sucked. Laura Linney's fucking fantastic.
That moment where she has excited like, thing on the stairs. Exactly. You feel her excitement. She's fucking amazing.
Exactly. And I guess the point is sometimes it's like, I know I'm kind of going on a rant here, but when you go to like a boxing match and it's not a boxing match that's actually ranked, it's just like an exhibition fight. And that's what this felt like. This felt like an exhibition fight of a movie where it's like, okay, we're going to get a bunch of really famous people that everybody knows, but the movie doesn't really count for anything. This is just a bunch of weird stories and we're going to just kind of all put it together. That's what I think. I gave it a 5 out of 10. 5 out of 10, but 0 out of 10, no trains.
Yeah. Like I said, 6 out of 10, which is weird because like I felt like I would have given it less, but after going through our discussions, mm-hmm. I think a 6 out of 10. Like, it's not the, my God, like, it's not the worst.
No. No.
It's not the worst thing we've ever watched.
Okay, finally, what is our watch this, not that suggestion? I'm going to let you go first while I think of one, because this was something that I totally flew past and didn't read it. So I have to kind of think about it real quick on the fly and pretend like I had it on there the entire time.
All right. If we're sticking with holiday movies that center around romance, and if you want another movie featuring big names from around the same time period, The Holiday with Cameron Diaz and Kate Winslet. However, if you are looking for a recent movie that is more like Hallmark Christmas movie, I'm going to say A Biltmore Christmas, which came out last year.
My Christmas movie that I would recommend watching is Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Great noir film, takes place during Christmas time. There's love in it. There's a love story. I think it's fantastic. And there's murder too, which is cool.
It's a totally different... I know. I'm not disagreeing with it, but yeah.
I can't think of another Christmas movie because I've just never really been into like Christmas movie stuff to like begin with. So I can't think.
Dude, I wasn't either until a few years ago. So as we close out the episode, we just want to give a shout out to our heroes, to our patron, Tommy of the TKOK Podcast Network. I've had a lot of wine tonight. Thank you so much for supporting us. Thank you to our listeners for joining us for 90s and Naughties Cringe Factor Holidays Special on Love Actually. For the most current news and updates about the Geek Saga podcast, make sure to follow at Geek Saga on Blue Sky, Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube. Please also consider supporting us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment. I apologize for being so drunk.
Yeah, this one did it for us.
Listen, it's my birthday. Quite. Not like right. Wait.
Almost though. Almost.
Yeah, it's almost. Not my birthday right this second, but I'm celebrating my birthday. So I do what I do.
Exactly. So
yes.
Everyone, please exit on the rear of the train, not the front. Grab your stuff. The train will be back next time.
We'll be back, I don't know, next month or something. Bye.
Next month or something. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Geek Saga podcast. If you like what you heard, please check out other Geek Saga entertainment endeavors, including the Sagas and Sass webcast and podcast, and Ice and Fire Con.